Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela Orkin, and I'm here with Bill in New York City. We're excited to have with us Curry Cook. Curry is with Lambda Legal in New York, and he serves in the role of counsel and also Youth and Out-of-Home Care Project Director. And in that role, he does a number of things, including being an advocate for LGBTQ youth and child welfare. He also has a book called Safe Havens that we highly recommend to all of you on this topic. Welcome, Curry.
Thank you.
So when we were sitting around the table one day and developing podcast ideas, episode ideas, we usually end up talking cases that we have and how do we confront certain issues and getting children home as quickly as we can. And in that, we talked about the LGBTQ population and that it's overrepresented in foster care. And from there, we went into, well, how do you really talk to these children and how do we really meet the needs of these children? Because it seems like if they're overrepresented, there's a problem of some sort that needs to be addressed, and do we even understand what that is? And so in that I went, oh wait, I know this attorney. I had seen Curry's, you did a presentation years ago in Florida, two lawyers and I think caseworkers too in the Palm Beach County system. And I remember you did this whole presentation, that part of your presentation is to explain how large and diverse and different this population is, and I just was wondering if you could share some of that for our listeners.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here and also for having a conversation on this topic, because I do think, even though we've made a ton of progress generally in society, I'm not sure a lot of that has really trickled down into the child welfare system as much as it should have, so it's really, really critical that we continue to heighten awareness. And what we do know is that if somebody's going to be there pushing the system on your behalf and making sure they're treating you right, it's going to be your attorney. And I think we have a lot that are doing an amazing job and a lot that could use a whole lot more information. And a whole lot of bad stuff that's gone on over the years for our clients that many of us have just not been aware of. So thank you. I think it is good for people to know what the numbers are. According to one federal study, about 20% of kids in the child welfare system are LGBTQ. And within that 20%, 5.6% identified as transgender, one study, which if we think about the numbers in the general population for trans youth, it's 1% to 2% by our best estimate. So talk about a whopping overrepresentation, which I think kind of dovetails with a little bit with where society is around trans people still and understanding so much bias and discrimination, and also just the overwhelming number one factor driving overrepresentation, which is family rejection, and that probably being higher among trans youth. But still, even for LGBTQ young people in general, that's about half our estimate in the general population, which is about 10%. And then I think the critical piece about that, too, is really talking accurately about who's in care. So if we know that youth of color are overrepresented in almost every state across the country and LGBTQ youth, what we're really talking about is LGBTQ youth of color, which are you thinking about the topic or the notion of intersectionality of sort of different aspects of your identity as you navigate the world. You've got kids in care, you're experiencing racism, bigotry. We know youth from low-income families are highly overrepresented in the system. So you have so many isms in society and discriminations like coming down kind of all together on this population in care. And that's layered on top of the challenges every young person in foster care faces.
So the question for, I guess, us is, number one, how do we even speak with this population, with this clientele, right? And can we actually speak to them as we perceive them? And I've gotten in trouble with that. I've assumed one thing when actually it's another, but my eyes were telling me one thing. And then once I do, if I ever can get that permission to actually speak to them as they are, how do I represent them? What special things, or not special, but what additional things do I need to do to make sure that they get out of care as quickly as possible? And maybe sometimes I think, well, it's the same. You treat a child the same. There's a path to permanency. But is it because there's this population is so overrepresented? I think, well, no, there's got to be something more that I need to look at. So is there anything you can help us with on that?
Sure. I'll just tackle the conversation part first, because I think that is probably the most important thing Attorneys for Children can do, is just to move towards having a proactive conversation with your clients about how they identify in all aspects.
But what's that mean, proactive? What do you mean by that?
So what I mean by that is asking the question. So everyone, even they meet with their clients for the first time, you have your spiel, you have your thing you do to introduce yourself, explain your role, all of that. So I think you can start at the very, very beginning and actually weave in some of the things I'm going to say into what you already do. So this isn't like one more thing, really. It's sort of just doing what you already do in a different way. So for example, I can say, if I'm having a first meeting, obviously depending on the age, right?
Right, right.
But you have a file, you have a court document, you're sitting with your client. So my name is Curry. I go by my middle name. My first name is Marshall, but I've always gone by Curry. It's Marshall Curry Cook. I use he, him, and his pronouns. I got this case from the court, and this paper that I have in front of me says your legal name is Jennifer Smith. Do you use Jennifer, or is there another name that you go by? And what pronouns should I use to refer to you?
But are you doing this because they are presenting differently? Or
no.
This is just standard
I'm
for every person
every
you talk to?
Every single client that comes in the door. Now, is a client, might some clients say, what is a pronoun? Possibly, right? Might some clients say, wait, do you think I'm gay? Could you have that reaction? Sure.
Right.
But you're automatically, like, for the population that you're trying to reach, you have done multiple things. And one thing, you have given space to recognize that there are some youth who don't use the legal name that you're seeing on the paper because they identify differently than the sex that they were assigned at birth and don't use that name. But also for all kids, you've opened up the possibility if you use a nickname or you actually, like me, go by your middle name rather than your first name. I mean, you're just opening up a space for individuality immediately, right? And then I think weaving in something along the lines of, you know, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my role as your attorney, what I do, what our relationship is going to be like, some of the rules, some of the parameters, however you explain that. And then say, what I want you to know is that when you're working with me, you have the expectation that I'm going to treat you fairly, regardless of who you are, your race, your religion, your sexual orientation, your gender identity. And you also have those rights to be treated fairly because of who you are while you're in the system. So I ask all my clients some questions around who they are in different aspects of their identity and about their experiences while they're in care, because otherwise I don't know if you're experiencing mistreatment or somebody's treating you badly or unfairly unless we're able to talk about it. So I'm going to ask you these questions. How do you identify in terms of your race? How do you identify in terms of your religion, or do you practice a religion at all or not? How do you identify in terms of your sexual orientation, your gender? You're just going through all the different aspects, mm-hmm. talking about whether you have any special needs or a disability, like many of the things that we ask about eventually, but we don't necessarily gather that information up front. And that's what I mean in a proactive way of sort of addressing these.
So I love the approach of asking the same questions in every case, because Bill and I were talking about this in preparing for the interview, and we're like, well, how, you know, do you have to know already from someone that this is an issue? And then, you know, how do you even go there as the attorney? Is this your business? And so the way you've laid it out, I think, is really excellent. I wonder, and you said depending on age, obviously, but have you ever had a negative reaction when you get to sexual orientation from a kid? Because I think people are going to have it. Because again, I think about my role, like, I'm good. And then you're like, sexual orientation. I'm like, well, can I ask that? You know, do you ever get a negative from that? And how can we give attorneys comfort that they should feel okay including that in the list of things?
Yeah, I think it it is challenging. So I recognize that this is something that you know, can cause some discomfort or apprehension. And I think there's a number of really understandable reasons for that. One, I think, honestly, is generational. I mean, I grew up in rural Georgia on a farm. If somebody had asked me as a teenager flat out, like, what my sexual orientation was, I probably would have just passed out right then and there. Like, I would, I mean, but that was a long time ago.
Right,
And, you know, things are different now. I mean, young people are having conversations amongst themselves about identity in all aspects in ways that just 3 years before kids weren't. So I think that's one thing that can cause us a little bit more security or reduce the apprehension a little bit, that this isn't something that's going to be foreign to most kids. And also now, like, our experiences in medical offices and just in life in general, like, more and more you're seeing questions about sexual orientation and gender identity appear on forms and other demographic information. So I think that's a piece of sort of, these are aspects that we all share. I mean, everybody has a sexual orientation and a gender identity. Your sexual orientation may be heterosexual, so you're in the majority, and you may identify the same as the sex that you were assigned at birth, so you're cisgender. So it's a piece of, like, these aren't, like, conversations we have to have, like, whispering in the corner, right? This is a part of who we all are. So I think a piece of it is moving towards normalizing that relationship. Another challenging part is we recognize, I think, increasingly over the last few years, how we don't have conversations about race and how difficult it is to have conversations about race. So, I mean, I didn't ask my clients. I just sort of assumed by looking at them how they might identify in terms of their race. I wasn't always asking about their religion. And, you know, faith and faith-based providers and religion is a major piece of the child welfare system. And so I think asking about all of these together helped kind of alleviate some of that tension around, oh, am I singling you out, right, to get at it?
Or am I putting you on the spot on a question you may be not ready to answer? Because, like, I started thinking in my mind, because I am in Georgia.
Right.
You know, sure. And I was thinking, well, of ways to ask the question that in a way that would allow them to answer or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Is there anything you want me to know about these? Or do you want to talk about how you know, I'm just thinking of of ways to do it where I like the idea of normalizing, but I also wouldn't want to pressure a kid to answer a question they're not ready to answer.
Sure.
And I'm sure you know exactly how
I think that's an excellent point to include. You know, these are totally voluntary. You don't have to answer any of them. It's just really helpful for me to do my job for you.
And I ask this of every
advocate.
I ask this of every client.
I ask everybody.
Something like that.
I ask everybody. I mean, the other thing I think, you know, prior to becoming an attorney for kids, I wasn't comfortable talking about domestic violence within families, about sexual abuse. I mean, as attorneys for children, we have to talk with our clients about lots of really challenging subjects that we don't talk about with other people. And I do, another piece I think is that, like, well, this isn't my business, but it is actually your business in these types of cases, because where your client is placed, that in and of itself, the one thing, there are so many bad things that can be going on with your client just in terms of their placement if they're LGBTQ. And so if you don't know or aren't able to have a conversation with them about that, then you have no idea what's going on. And I can tell you from my conversations with so many of the young people I work with, almost to a person, they say, I would rather someone just have a conversation about this with me in a respectful way than be tippy-toeing around and just, you know, just not talk about it. You know, act like this is this one subject we can't talk about. That makes me feel far more uncomfortable than somebody just having a conversation with
me. That's a good point. That it's that, you know, because that's exactly what I think the natural reaction is. Well, I don't want to go there and say something offensive. I better not say anything. You know, then tread on this ground, and now I've offended my client. And but again, I like your way of going about it. But that leads me to another question.
Before you go there, though, for me, what keeps coming up in my head is, like, I feel like I should just just treat them as I see them. And not that I'm judging who they are, just like, why? I feel like I'm making a bigger deal about it if I am talking about it. And I want them just to feel like, hey, I am taking you as you are, even though I might not know what that is, because of course I didn't ask. But do you see, I'm thinking there are attorneys like me, like out there, that like, well, maybe I shouldn't be talking about it at all and let them just be who they are.
Well, I mean, while more and more LGBTQ youth are having positive experiences in life in general, it's an issue. There's just no way around it. Like, you know, in some aspects of their lives that have led them to care or currently in care, whether it's school, whether it's family, whether it's faith or challenges around being a person of faith or not because of your experiences, whether it's around messages you're getting in the media. I mean, something's going on that is impacting their life and care in some way. Now, we hope that it's a positive way. Right. I mean, the other thing that you may find out is getting to the permanency portion of the question. So a positive person in your life is your uncle, right, who is out and has been the one supportive in your family who's there, or your soccer coach who has been a support for you. Right. Finding out those folks, especially if you are experiencing rejection from certain aspects of your family, those could be considered fictive kin. Right, and be a placement, or those could be that one person that we're always supposed to find with an apple plan, right? Which never really seems to materialize in my experience, but hope springs eternal, and that could be that person. So I think it's always relevant in every single case.
I'm not saying that it's not relevant. I agree with you that it's relevant. It's just that I have questioned so much how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And obviously I don't want to belabor that point. Oh. But it's so interesting that you say that this is part of your intro in talking with them. I've not done it that way. I've always just kind of let it evolve. And maybe I learn about it three visits down the road, or we talk about it. And I might already know. But so it's interesting to hear that.
And of course, I mean, I think obviously you have to exercise your judgment, right?
Yeah,
I mean, if you're meeting a young person in a particularly stressful moment or there may be lots of reasons why you're not doing that right out of the gate. But I would say doing it just as soon as you can is important, because we've had kids, like, for example, a young woman that we work with in LA, she was at an emergency removal from home after her father came at her with an axe in the middle of the night. All sorts of issues he was having.
Yeah.
She was placed in the children's center in Los Angeles, and was actually placed, a trans girl, was actually placed in a big room that just had an imaginary line dividing the boys' section and the girls' section. She was placed dead in the middle across the line because she was neither, according to the staff. And ironically, was placed under, like, a safe space poster in the children's center. Was outed by a chalk, like a dry erase board, where they had the kids listed by gender, why they needed to be listed by gender, why there was an imaginary line in the room when the kids were supervised all night by a staff person who sat there watching them. Who knows? Right. But I mean, she was outed, which put her at risk. She was discriminated against. She was told she couldn't use the restroom consistent with her identity. I mean, this was after the trauma of just being removed in the middle of the night because your dad came at you.
Right.
Right. So immediately coming into care, this was an issue for her that had her attorney not been having this conversation with her about, wouldn't have even known like what was happening right at the get-go that was causing more trauma and harm to her. So,
we obviously don't want to re-traumatize the kids we represent.
Right.
Anyway, you had a question.
Well, I want to stay on the talking thing a little bit longer because
sure.
I think that I think that's something that would be very practical for people and helpful. So you've given us one way to go about a series of questions that could get at, if a child is ready to talk about it, that they would be talking to you. But are there things that well-meaning people say or ask that they just simply should not do? To just giving people comfort, like, this is one way to ask, but whatever you do, don't do this.
To some degree there are some things like that.
I know that people mean well, and we all think a certain way, but it's just not always in tune with what, and it could backfire. So if there are things that you've seen a lot of times, I think that would be great for people to hear too.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think one thing everyone can do, which I think was kind of where you were getting at, Bill, is think about the language that you're using and whether that's gendered or not in your discussion. So if you're having a conversation about, you know, dating or sexual health, you know, obviously asking, like, are you seeing someone versus saying, do you have a boyfriend or do you have a girlfriend, right? And assuming someone is heterosexual when they're not, right? Those are some simple things. Making sure that wherever you are, if you're having an interview in your office, that you have, you know, a rainbow sticker or flag up or safe space, or if you, you know, can wear something on your clothing, or if you have like a phone case cover having a rainbow sticker, like things like that that you can do that I think are immediately sending off signals to young people that you are going to be a safe person to talk to about. I think those are some things you can do. You know, one of the things I think we do in some trainings and practicing like role plays and interviewing is making sure that if a young person does disclose to you, that you immediately have a go-to, which is a simple one. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Like immediately letting folks know that you appreciate that, or, you know, I thought that may have been really challenging for you to share. But I really appreciate you trusting me with that. And then if a young person is using a term to describe themselves you're not familiar with, like queer, for example, right, a lot more young people are using that term, then a great thing to say is, so what does that mean to you? Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Obviously, it's not your client's obligation to educate you about being LGBT or about them, right? And you have an obligation to learn terms and educate yourself, but you're also immediately indicating an interest in them and understanding them better and opening up a line of conversations. Those are great ones. In terms of words to avoid, the one that I hear more often than I would like to at this point is lifestyle. I don't have a problem with your lifestyle. So for a lot of LGBT people, that has some real negative connotations because it's used so much by anti-LGBT folks to describe LGBT people. But as one of my former coworkers put it, like, RVing is a lifestyle.
RVing?
Oh, like, driving around in an RV.
This is an example
of a lifestyle.
Yes, right? Okay.
Being LGBT... There's not one particular way to be LGBT or a lifestyle.
Excellent point.
Yeah. So, right. Then, lifestyle. And I think the way some people use that is immediately in a negative way.
Yeah.
Right. And so that rubs people the wrong way a lot, which somebody can say being super supportive, right? I don't have a problem with your lifestyle. Like they're trying to convey that I'm, you know, I support you, I'm here, but then the person's hearing a completely different thing. The other one that some people don't still recognize is homosexual. Like, that term, while clinically accurate, it appears in the literature, you see it in news articles sometimes. For a lot of LGBT people, that is also kind of one that gives you a little pause because it's been used so much in a negative way. So
that's really helpful because I would not have known either of those. I don't know that I would have used either one, but I would not have seen those. If I heard someone else say it, I wouldn't have that reaction. And so I think that'd be very, very helpful. I'm sorry, Bill.
So once you meet your client and they're LGBTQ, one of whatever, how do you then refer to them in court? Do you ask them, well, when we're talking in court, if it's even necessary to bring up, I'm not sure it always is, but if it is, how do I refer? Do they tell you how to do it? Or do you have to figure out the term, or what do you do?
No, I think it's absolutely a conversation with your client about that. And I think that's also where the attorney as counselor role comes in. So a client of mine here in New York City, when I was with the Children's Law Center before joining Lambda Legal, we had a conversation about that. It was quite clear he was out to folks before, like in all the reports that I got and everything. So we were immediately able to have a conversation about it because it appeared in all the records and all that. But I specifically asked him how he would like to proceed in terms of being open in court and during the conversation, I said, I think it would be, if you're comfortable with it, I think it would be great to just address these issues head on and talk about what your experiences are while you're in care around these issues, what supports you need or don't need while you're in care, because they don't always get it right. And this may well be an issue. So if you're comfortable with that, I think that's a good course for us to pursue. And he was fine with that. And there was lots of stuff happened, right, that we needed to talk about in court on that point. But I think that's going to be different, of course, for every young person. And also, I think that's a good question, too, right off the bat, is who else are you out to? Because you need to know that, right? A young person may be out to you and not to the caseworker. They may be out to one parent and not another, or, you know.
You need to know all whether to hold that in confidence.
Right.
Because if that's...
the confidence. Yeah. And also, right, it comes up in court reports mentioning. It can come up in a psychological evaluation or assessment and then gets attached to a report. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that confidentiality can be breached. So that's definitely an issue that you may have to help your client navigate. And so kind of knowing that up front is really helpful.
So that wraps up part one of our interview with Curry Cook. Stay tuned for part two. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.